KTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is up next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Before we get to the Tuesday morning show, we want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio's year-end membership drive is currently underway. WGTD is part of Wisconsin Public Radio, and our well-being is very directly dependent on their well-being. So if you appreciate what you hear over Wisconsin Public Radio and what you hear over WGTD, I would urge you to make a year-end gift in whatever amount you are able to do so. And you're invited to go to their website, which is WPR.org, WPR.org. Or you can take a few moments and call toll-free 1-888-202-2552. Again, 1-888-202-2552. And when you do so, please mention that you are a listener to WGTD and The Morning Show, and we appreciate your support. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Very happy to be sitting across the table from a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, author of The Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country and actually abroad as well, and Professor Sear. Boy, I gave you quite a promotion, didn't I?
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, right. It's a compliment. Professor Sear joins us once a month.
Sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Joins us once a month to offer his commentary on a variety of issues. And there's a long list to get to today. So for this last conversation of 2018, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thanks, Greg, and thanks for the unintended compliment. And it's nice to be here. As the cow said to the farmer, thank you for the warm greeting on a cold morning.
Yes.
Better than the other way around.
Right. Absolutely. So great to have you here. I think we should probably begin with President George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right.
And, of course, he was recently laid to rest, and there was much discussion about his legacy. You were moved to write a column about former President Bush.
Well, thank you for reading it. Yes, indeed, last week's column.
Right. So tell our listeners your primary thoughts about President Bush, and in particular, which is what you wrote about in your column, what seemed to have been his primary gifts and highest priorities as an American.
Tremendous executive ability, more than natural political ability. He was not a natural elected politician in the modern party sense. But he overcame the barriers, including a kind of awkward public style, to obviously great success. since the articles, the column's readily available for anybody who's interested on the internet. Let me supplement what I wrote with a couple of other more personal comments. Tom Clawson, our namesake of our Clawson Center and our Carthage graduate and trustee, who ended up leading both Bank of America very effectively and the World Bank very effectively, he was a Carter nominee. He served and worked under Reagan, whom he knew. He was head of the bank the first time around when Reagan was governor of California, and the bank was then based in San Francisco. The president he really admired and got to know well, however, was George Herbert Walker Bush. I was very much struck by that. And it was a function of the fact they were both very able and accomplished men and leaders. But also Bush seemed more like an executive than a natural politician. His brilliant leadership during the first Gulf War is only one of several examples. I had the honor of being around him briefly in 1980. He came to the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, where I used to work. Before Super Tuesday came in the 1980s, the Illinois primary was often pivotal. And we had both Bush and Reagan, Ted Kennedy. President Carter was pursuing a strategy of not campaigning that year, given the Iran hostage crisis. We were supposed to have John Connally, but he dropped out because he was getting virtually no support, even though he raised a vast amount of money. And I had the chance to be around the future president, future vice president, that year, not only for the public lecture, but also a small reception that we organized for CEOs. Former governor and secretary Connally was a kind of Pied Piper for corporate chieftains, and the head of Sara Lee and FMC and Continental Bank and Quaker Oats and on and on and on. These men, all male in those days, lined up behind him, even though he wasn't getting any public support. He did come to the council separately, and I had a chance to meet him. But even in the context of the CEOs, George Herbert Walker Bush was so dynamic and so forceful and so highly intelligent that he was really the center of gravity beyond his candidacy. It was a good reflective lesson to me on the distorting prism of television, because the same qualities that seemed kind of frantic on TV in person were remarkably effective. An extraordinary person, and I must say also a gentleman. All too rare then and now.
Yeah. At that point in time, what was he doing? He was not yet vice president, so where
was he? He was seeking the Republican nomination.
I mean, was he, was that at the point when he was with the CIA, or did he hold?
Well, he was running full-time for president.
Oh, no, okay.
He previously had been with the CIA, and I believe he was formerly between jobs.
Okay.
Well, politics is very much a full-time job, but you're quite right. He was a very effective head of the CIA, ambassador to the United Nations, our representative in China early on, a remarkable resume, as various people would point out.
Were you struck, as I think a lot of people were, at how we see somebody and perhaps more deeply appreciate them in retrospect than perhaps we do at the time? It seems to me that that's exceptionally true when it comes to George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yes.
At least as far as the public is concerned.
Yeah, senior leaders in particular often are more well-defined in hindsight. We're now building a large monument, literally enormous, to President Dwight Eisenhower in Washington. It's Frank Gehry, very fashionable and very rich, as well as professionally successful architect in L.A., has been commissioned to do this, and he's building a kind of Roman Hollywood imperial memorial to Ike. Eisenhower would have been appalled by the whole thing, I'm quite confident. But at the time, Eisenhower was always enormously popular with the average American, but he was not popular with the intellectual elite and media people, such as it was, and a lot of very sophisticated people tended to denigrate his abilities. Given events since and the problems he avoided, especially the chaos and violence of the 1960s when we had an awful lot of mismanagement at the top of our government, it's only in hindsight that's a particularly dramatic example of a president, and starting in the 1980s, about 20 years after the fact, academics, as well as journalists and other serious professionals, started dramatically revising their view of Eisenhower. Somewhat similar phenomenon applies to Harry Truman. In the case of Bush, it's particularly anomalous because he was quite popular. He was up in the 90s that in terms of poll approval rating, which had been equaled only by Harry Truman for a brief period of time after Franklin Roosevelt's death in 1945. But Bush declined very, very rapidly, and a gifted public campaigner, Bill Clinton, quite surprisingly, seemed to come out of nowhere and defeat him. So it's a good dramatic reminder that politics is a particularly rough trade.
It sure is. By the way, did you happen to watch the funeral for President Bush, that or the memorial service that happened at the National Cathedral?
I saw parts of it. Yeah, yes, indeed. Thanks to our president, John Swallow, at the college, and Tom Klein, our head of development, we had John Meacham, the very successful and very serious author and biographer of George Herbert Walker Bush, among other people he's written about and events. He was our commencement speaker this year, as you know, and I was very pleased indeed. I'm sorry Carthage College wasn't mentioned, but I'm very pleased indeed that Mr. Meacham was so prominently featured memorial service, both in public and private. Meacham acquitted himself extremely well at the college.
Yeah, and he delivered a fine eulogy at that service.
As did others, including James Baker,
right,
former Secretary of State.
And, of course, George W. Bush, the former president's son, who also, I thought, acquitted himself well in a difficult moment.
Well, of course, and we're all familiar with him, even younger people for whom the father is very much an historical figure.
Right. Let's turn our attention to some current matters, and one of them, especially dramatic, is the difficulty that continues to swirl around Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May, and this thing called Brexit, Great Britain's exit from the European Union. And the headlines this morning are of a vote being delayed because of the almost certain defeat that it would have brought. The New York Times characterized it as a humiliating retreat for the Prime Minister, who had apparently worked really, really hard on this kind of compromise strategy for leaving the EU, and a compromise that seems not to have pleased anybody. What can you tell us about this really difficult situation that both Britain and her Prime Minister are facing right now?
The Prime Minister is caught in this terrible dilemma. There's very strong and intense sentiment in her own party to withdraw from the EU. She's part of, at the time, younger generation of Tories who came in their general election sweep in 1997 into the House of Commons. And ironically, because it was Harold Macmillan and the Conservative Party of the 60s that dramatically shifted from Britain's traditional aloofness from Europe and made the first moves to join the European Economic Community at that time. The Conservative Party has changed a lot since then, and the British always are ambiguous collectively about how much to be involved with the continent historically and currently, but she personifies this basic hostility to Europe. At the same time, in terms of trade, finance, tourism, as well as migration for employment reasons, Britain is increasingly intricately tied with the rest of Europe. So she's on the horns of this dilemma, as we say, that they don't want to be involved, but reality dictates they have to be involved. I regularly remind myself, as well as others, I'm an academic, I'm not any kind of practicing political leader. She may be playing a kind of big-time chicken. That is, she wants the country to withdraw, as do her strongest supporters in the party and in the public. And she may be hoping that since leaving with no deal on March 29 would be so bad, that eventually people will go along with this. That's one generous interpretation. She does seem to be rather brittle and rigid, and it may well be just a basic miscalculation on her part.
Mm.
What I can go on and on and on about the European Union, but we'd lose all our listeners.
Well, but it's incredibly important, and of
it
course,
is. Yes, indeed.
And one reason that this is significant is because I don't think anybody would say that the same forces of the same level are present, but there are rumblings in other nations like France and Italy. Certain factions of those populations as well also are being rather open about their dissatisfaction with the European Union, and so it's maybe under more public fire than it's been, and so I think a lot of people are watching how Brexit is going to play out. What are the most significant ways in which Britain herself would be hurt by kind of a rough exit from the European Union? I mean, in other words, what kind of damage are they trying to prevent in crafting a smoother withdrawal from?
Well, they want to stay within the customs union. That is, trade barriers, tariffs and non-tariff barriers especially, have been removed as a result of the European integration process. And institutionally, a high priority, understandably, for Britain has been to make it less painful and less disruptive by keeping those trade, relatively free trade understandings in place. The Europeans say, of course, at the same time they want to remove themselves from what people view as burdensome administrative decisions, from the onerous and time-consuming form-filling out that goes along with bureaucracy, and from the legal decisions handed down by administrators as well as judicial officials in Brussels and The Hague. Europeans say, well, the British want to have their cake and eat it too. But that has been sort of, as I understand the complex process, a basic sticking point. If Britain just withdraws, almost certainly for basic manufacturing and the kind of tangible physical jobs that a lot of working people have, it would be very disruptive and would almost certainly increase unemployment. In the area of financial services, where Britain is very, very strong, Britain has never joined the common currency, the euro. They still have the British pound. In that area, it would be disruptive, but my guess is those fears are probably exaggerated. When the euro came into effect in the early 90s and then early, in a preliminary way in the early 90s, and then finally in a practical way early in this century, there was a lot of speculation that the British would be in terrible trouble because they were sticking with the pound. That hasn't been the case. Finally, since you want to talk about the EU, please keep in mind that the basic genesis and basic incentives for the initial cooperation economically in Europe wasn't commercial, and it wasn't business-driven. It was government and business and other public leaders determining that this was the most promising strategy, a strategy developed even during World War II to keep the Germans at bay, bluntly, and prevent another horrific third war in Europe. The goals were strategic, political, and military, and in that sense, the European Union has worked, along with NATO, has worked extraordinarily well. Hmm. And the presidents criticized by many look increasingly good, Truman and Eisenhower and their associates, because with enormous consistency and farsightedness, and Roosevelt and Churchill for that matter, but after the war, the U.S. played a very positive and sustained leading role, unlike today in my view, in this economic integration movement to forestall war and encourage stability. We paid a certain price. We could afford to do it, given our enormous wealth and economic dominance during and after World War II. We could afford it, but nonetheless, the American people, as well as our leaders, should be complimented for the fact that we tolerated tariffs and other barriers in Europe and in Japan in order to get these countries up and running and promote a more peaceful approach to the world.
Hmm.
That's the most important point, and almost universally overlooked in popular discussion about Brexit and exit and butter and milk and trade and unemployment. These are the kinds of things that in a free society, or you know, there are always headaches.
Right, right.
But the basic strategic goal has been achieved. I'm struggling to do some writing beyond these weekly columns on the subject. And I hope to get something more serious published in the fairly near future.
You have something important to say, I know.
Well, thank you very much.
Particularly the nation of France is, and their leaders are racked with some challenges right now. It sounds like involving, in particular, maybe the middle class in France, and particularly in the rural areas, who feel, in a sense, kind of left behind by some of the more progressive moves of the French government, in some odd echoes of what's already been happening here in the United States. It seems to me that it feels like at least somewhat similar kind of divide that Prime Minister Macron is having to deal with. What do you think is most important for us to take away from what's going on in France right now?
There's a much stronger tradition of populism and direct action in France, dating from the French Revolution, than in Britain. The British solved that kind of basic challenge in the 1600s with their own very bloody civil war and regicide and a military dictatorship under Cromwell. The French had a very violent revolution, and unlike the British, have never really been able to return to pretty predictable stability. The British struggle with federalism and how much to give to the regions, but there's no basic doubt about the durability of institutions. The French are rather different, and Emmanuel Macron is drawing very directly from Charles de Gaulle's playbook. De Gaulle was the great leader of Free France, really great leader of Free France during the war, and then came back in the midst of chaos in fear of a total collapse of the state in the late 1950s. And from 58 to 1968, he put in place very strong governmental institutions, and he greatly strengthened a French tradition of appealing directly to the people over television. In some ways, a bizarre 19th century figure, like others we've been talking about. He didn't project all that well over TV as opposed to in person, but he would put on his military uniform. He was a general officer and a real one, and go on television and appeal to the people directly at very difficult times. And Macron is trying very hard. He doesn't have the stature, but he's using the same playbook, trying very hard to use this approach to encourage unity in the midst of very strong popular demonstrations, which the French regularly go through, often farmers, but also everybody else. And in point of fact, the middle class is squeezed, and working people are squeezed, and expectations are much higher, quite rightly, than they were in earlier times. So in his television address, he not only tried to appeal directly to the people and come across not as the still remarkably young, extraordinarily arrogant investment banker that he really is, but as a man who understands the people's pain, so to speak. De Gaulle was brilliant at it and had endless credibility, and Macron's trying to use, I believe, that same approach.
Interesting.
He's going to increase the minimum wage, and he's going to cut taxes, and he's going to do other things. The French have a very intrusive state. Samuel Beer at Harvard many years ago, a great, really great scholar and teacher and brilliant analyst of British politics and history, said, you know, the British really like a lot of weak government. The French, before, during, and after the French Revolution, have more or less had an extraordinarily strong centralized government. And it's not surprising that it's vexing for the people.
Interesting. And I suppose time will only tell in terms of how effective Macron's efforts are in terms of trying to pull the nation together and quell some of unrest.
It's certainly been a good education for the young president. And since he is super smart, my guess is, thanks to de Gaulle, the president of France has even greater executive authority. De Gaulle put the Fifth Republic Constitution in place very consciously. The president has, I believe, a seven-year term. Enormous executive power, going beyond even the formal powers of the President of the United States. So he has a lot of tools at his disposal. De Gaulle was also very hostile to the European Union. And indeed, the greatest crisis in Europe was in 1966-67, when the bureaucrats in Brussels decided to try to get their own independent financing, directly collect customs income. And de Gaulle went right up to the brink of destroying the European economic community to get them to back down. Since that time, of course, they've got all kinds, enormous sources of direct income, and the institutions have evolved. But de Gaulle's nationalism was so strong that he just couldn't abide these, any kind of serious European institutions. What we don't hear about in either Britain or France is those terrible foreigners across the border and deeply rooted hostility between Britain and France. Between Britain and France directly is nowhere in evidence in the current situation, even though, as you indicate, both countries are in a their leaders are in a challenging situation.
Right. And by the way, although we don't have much time to talk about...
Well, you said you want to talk about Brexit and the EU,
no,
so here we go.
Yeah, right. I do want to just mention briefly that someone else you greatly admire, Angela Merkel in Germany, has also been under kind of increasing pressure in the most recent elections there. We're not exactly rosy for her and her own party. What do you see ahead for her and for Germany?
Well, she is going to retire as chancellor. She's going to be succeeded in party by her designated successor, a younger version of herself. And that means that as a gray eminence and kind of senior figure, she's still young enough, and we live longer nowadays. There are a lot of things she could do. I'm a great admirer of hers. And it'll be interesting to see what her next job will be. But I believe if... the CDU-CSU, the Conservative Christian Democratic Christian Social Union coalition that has really dominated post-unification Germany in a grand coalition for a while now, I believe she'll continue to have a political role. She could be she could be the president of Germany, I believe, a kind of senior statesman or woman's role that the Germans have in place constitutionally. I don't know. Oh, she'd be a good Secretary General of the UN. I think there are all kinds of things she could do.
Wow.
Remarkably effective long-term leader in Germany, precisely the kind of stability they need. Hmm. And it goes beyond elected office. You know, you think of the Queen of England or Queen Victoria, especially in the 1800s, someone who's been able to transcend politics and given Germany's history. She's particularly reassuring across generations. The Germans seem to look to her as a reassuring figure. Who knows what we'll get if we turn her out?
Yeah, right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. Paying the last of his monthly visits to the morning show during 2018, and we look forward to more conversations in 2019. Professor Sear, I didn't mention this ahead of the program as something we would talk about, but it occurs to me that you might have a thought or two to share about something really close to home, namely the move that has been made by the Republican-controlled Wisconsin state legislature moving to limit the powers, the authority of the governor, who will soon be Democrat, Tony Evers, and also limiting the powers of the attorney general as well, in a move that has really generated lots of attention all across the country, and of course from certain sectors, outrage over what has been done, and of course people more sympathetic to the Republicans, do not view it that way, of course, at all. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that, and if are we seeing something unprecedented here?
Well, I'm here mainly to talk about foreign policy, Greg.
Right.
But since I'm a professor, I've got an opinion on everything, and I'm willing to lecture endlessly. I think the Republicans are being very short-sighted, petty, and vindictive. And if I'd had a chance to think about it, I probably would have said, watch Scott Walker, a very clever, very durable, very smart politician. He's still pretty young. I believe he's in his early 50s. And I'm sure he's still very ambitious. See how he tries to finesse this during his remaining days and hours in office. But it's not unprecedented. Republicans have pulled this in other states. and I believe Democrats have too, but I think, especially nowadays, when it's harder to hide, it's so transparent and so transparently self-serving, so cynical, and so mean-spirited that it will probably boomerang. Wisconsin is not a Republican state, contrary to what we've heard in the media in recent years endlessly. It's a swing state, and the Republican Party historically is not a right-wing party in this state. I think it's very short-sighted. I'm sure that our friends at public radio will be continue to pay close attention to this and put their own dispassionate eye very forcefully on what the Republicans are doing.
A lot of people are paying attention to this, rightfully so. And I saw a headline.
Watch Walker. Walker, because he's smart. He's successful. He only barely lost the last election. And see how he plays this. My guess is he will not embrace it totally.
And I saw a headline in The Guardian, although I've not been able to read the article yet.
The British paper.
The
liberal
British
paper.
There's someone else paying attention to Wisconsin, saying that it's quite possible that that this move could actually be struck down in the courts, be found as unconstitutional, which is also intriguing. I would love to ask, for instance, Robin Voss, who one of the forces behind this move, how closely they examined that sort of issue, the constitutionality of this.
Well, I'm so very glad you read The Guardian in Britain, and I urge you to read The Telegraph as well and The Financial Times.
Let's move on to a high-level resignation it's a little hard to characterize exactly what it is, but the fact that President Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, is going to be stepping down. And it is a moment that has people kind of talking about the significance of that role and the importance, particularly with this president, of there being an effective chief of staff in place. What can you tell us about that role, just kind of in general? Has that been somebody who's really mattered in the past?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, given the basically impossible nature of the presidency and big jobs in Washington overall. Yeah, it's been a very, very important job, starting with the New Deal, but especially since World War II. And James Baker first generated tremendous respect at the federal level when he served as chief of staff for President Reagan, as well as Secretary of the Treasury, close friend and ally of George Herbert Walker Bush, whom we discussed at length. A very smart, very successful attorney, as well as teacher, who's been very supportive of Carthage College and added a lot of value, and who's basically supportive of the president, I believe, said, the president's, Trump's main problem is he can't get out of his own way. And he needs someone to save him from himself. And I believe we've all been very, very fortunate, perhaps blessed, that we have people like Mattis and Kelly and others in place who've been able to add some discipline and selflessness to very important jobs in Washington.
Right.
Yeah, I think Trump, the president's been very fortunate to have someone like him in that position.
Right. It's intriguing to me. There hasn't been a lot of clear language about just exactly what this departure is. Is it John Kelly willingly retiring?
Yeah, I don't know. He may have decided he's just had enough.
Right. Or has there been a falling out? Given that it's a really important position, and particularly with this particular president, it's interesting that such an important move is so, in a sense, such an unknown, as is the unknown of who's going to step into the breach now, who is going to succeed him.
Like I've had the opportunity to say on your program before, I believe there is an unholy alliance between the media, including public radio and television, of course, and the president. They feed off each other. And news increasingly, just in this administration, has been replaced, in effect, not just by entertainment, by endless speculation. And I think for that reason especially, we should stick to the facts and pay close attention to who succeeds General Kelly, whom I admire tremendously. You don't become a Marine Corps general. A general in any of the services, but a four-star Marine Corps general is a very able person indeed.
For sure. Let's talk about the volatility of the stock market and the fact that basically all of the gains of 2018 have been wiped out by the several big plunges that occurred towards the end of the year. What is your sense of what's going on there?
Well, I'm honored you would ask a political economy professor what's going on. I don't know. I know what's going on this morning. I have no idea what's going to go on tomorrow. And those who do are mistaken. I don't think there's going to be a great crash. To actually answer your question, I was a lot more worried.
And just to be clear, I wasn't asking for a prediction. I was asking what's going on. Like, why has this been happening?
Well, To actually answer your question, we're returning to normalcy. We've had a calmness in the market this last year that was eerie, very little volatility at all. And it was a direct function, I think, of the fact that the Fed was it's too crude to say giving away free money, but interest rates were nil and so low for such a long period of time to underwrite the recovery from the tremendous economic financial crash that became global. U.S. crash that became global in 2007, 8 into 2009, and the serious recession, that there were not a lot of other investment options. That's not healthy. And as the Fed has slowly but fairly steadily raised interest rates, people have other investment options, and the market is returning to normalcy. Stocks for the last 100 years, since a professor can confidently focus on the past, for the last 100 years and more, long-term, thinking not necessarily in terms of a century but several decades, it's still a very, very good investment as long as you diversify. And as long as you study the market and do real research and don't rely on the television and the internet, really work at this, you can make money in the stock market.
Right. And that's an interesting perspective. I mean, obviously,
well, I'm glad to hear that.
It runs contrary to, I think, the assumption that most of us make, that when the stock market plunges 900 points in a day and 500 points a couple days later, it feels like anything but a return to normalcy. But what you're saying is it was overdue and it needed to happen. It was one of those corrections.
Talking about hundreds of points, but look at percentages, sir. You know, and the percentage shifts have not been that great.
Sure.
Now, the media is very, very subversive of that because it's nonstop hysteria almost on what used to be serious discussion of financial matters. But the percentage shifts have been small. When they get to be over 10%, 15%, 20%, as they were during the last financial crash, but we're talking about a 24,000, 25,000 market.
Right. No, that's true.
Please do keep
that
in mind.
Sure. Of course, on the other hand, you yourself just said we went through most of 2018 with, I mean, I think you said almost like an eerie steadiness of the numbers. So
the global financial system, now dominated since the war by the Americans, was basically defined by the British. And John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist who was paramount in putting together the Bretton Woods UN economic structure that continues to provide global stability, he talked about the liquidity and wrote about the liquidity trap that is like a ship becalmed at sea with no wind. With no wind. That's very dangerous because you don't know what to do, and there's very little that you can do. Now, he was talking and writing in the 1930s and 40s, but I thought of that more than once during 2017 when we had such calm financial markets and banks and other financial institutions, the fat cats, as people would talk about during really hard times in the 30s, they were hoarding their cash. They're not doing that so much anymore.
Right.
That's encouraging.
Yeah.
It's still tough. It's still tough to make money, and it's still tough to be a serious investor.
Right.
And it's even tougher if you're not serious, because when you lose your shirt and you lose your pants, then you realize that you shouldn't be casual about the marketplace, which is treacherous and rough and ruthless.
Right, right.
And some people embrace dictators.
Yeah. It's an interesting picture. It reminds me of the famous poem, Calm Sea and Prosperous Voyage. And of course, people glance at the title and think, it's about two great things, a calm sea and a prosperous voyage, and it's not. It's about, first, something terrible, a ship marooned in the middle of the ocean because it's a calm sea, back in the age where boats were dependent on the wind. And then once the winds begin to blow again, then the prosperous voyage can begin. And mm-hmm. in a sense, that's what you're talking about here.
Well, you're quite eloquent on financial matters.
We'll move right on from that to the fact that in some of the concerns that are raised about the economy, one of the things people point to actually is China, and the fact that China has engaged in almost kind of a flamboyant building craze, and maybe has gotten a little bit ahead of itself. And I was just reading in the New York Times this morning about how that is one source of concern in terms of the global financial picture, is what is the health of China right now? And have they extended themselves and their own debt to an extent that's has been unwise? I haven't read a whole lot about that, but I know that there is this interesting phenomenon of almost kind of like ghost cities that have been created in China, huge construction of cities and factories and so on, and then nobody's there and nothing's happening because the growth they thought it would usher in has not, in a sense, materialized. That's probably oversimplifying the situation, but it makes it sound like China itself is perhaps in a somewhat tenuous or fragile position at the moment.
I wouldn't put it in terms of fragility, but I do believe you're describing a basic reality. It's an enormous economy. It is the second largest economy in the world per capita. It's much smaller than that. Japan and the U.S. remain the top economies in the world. When you divide things by factors that are really significant, like population, they still are woefully lacking in terms of infrastructure and the current buzzword, transparency. There's a tremendous amount of corruption, and there is tremendous state control. The communist elite in Beijing learned a lot from what happened in the Soviet Union, and they so far have been extremely effective at maintaining tight state control and surviving. But that's fundamentally counterproductive for a free economy, and when the president writes himself into the Constitution and develops a personality cult around himself, it's an enormously powerful and enormously successful economy in physical terms. And I dare say China will continue to grow important. But when the president acts like a banana republic dictator or some third world tyrant or some totalitarian tyrant of the 20th century in terms of his behavior and public relations, I think that's a sign that they still have a long way to go.
Interesting.
Yeah, and the problem of corruption, I do believe that President Trump is right to emphasize the not only lack of transparency, but theft. I mean, very, very blatant theft and heavy-handed gangster tactics applied to large corporations to squeeze them for proprietary information and also concessions and bribes, in effect. Although it might be put more politely, that economy is not that strong, and we have the leverage to pressure them on these matters.
Interesting. As we head into 2019, we are looking at a very different Congress. The U.S. Senate still, of course, in Republican control, but now a U.S. House of Representatives.
They expanded their majority, didn't they?
Right. But now the Democrats taking hold of the U.S. House of Representatives. And they, of course, face a very interesting dilemma in terms of, I mean, on a host of issues, but in particular when it comes to their relationship with President Trump and what they will choose to investigate and so on. What would your advice be for these Democrats who now find themselves with control of the U.S. House of Representatives. And is this a dilemma we've seen before?
Well, the American people seem to be more comfortable with divided government rather than single-party control. Nancy Pelosi now is right up there with Sam Rayburn in terms of length of tenure as Speaker of the House. She's in a position to really, in a disciplined way, define and drive public policy in this country. She's a remarkably talented tactician, politician, and political operator. Driving up this morning, I was listening to public radio, of course, and there was an interesting analogy with 1994 when the Republicans for the first time in 40 years under Newt Gingrich took over the House of Representatives and put Democratic President Bill Clinton into a dilemma, as we say in current language, which he handled quite brilliantly. Newt Gingrich was effectively sidelined over time as a credible and influential political player, and the president, including at least one government shutdown, was able to, by his second term, reestablish a dominant position in driving policy. And I do think studying how President Clinton, a truly brilliant politician, and Washington player, even though he was not a Washington veteran, handled things, certainly should be instructive for the current president.
Interesting.
I would bet on Nancy, if I were a betting person, which of course I am not, I would bet on Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats to be extremely effective. She's quite a remarkable politician.
Right.
And in contrast to Prime Minister May, she doesn't seem to have a brittleness about her. Like Sam Rayburn and other really successful legislative leaders, and Lyndon Johnson in the Senate, not the White House, she's got a real opportunity to really have a sustained long-term effect on policy.
Interesting. And of course,
that is very interesting. I'm glad you brought it up.
And it's interesting to also watch kind of the discussion that took place about amongst Democrats that should this be the face of the party at this point, or is it time for some fresh new face to represent this wave of new Democrats coming into the House? It's just been kind of remarkable to see how that has played out. I mean, it gets you talking about and thinking about what one needs in party leadership at any point in time. And
I've been told by people who know, like other effective people, including Lyndon Johnson, she is much better off TV than on TV. It's not a friendly medium for her. So let's pay close attention to what actually comes out. She can be rather off-putting on television. Like we were talking about earlier, it's a very curious prism. Hmm. And political judgment, of course, is separate from and policy judgment is separate from your ability to project well. But
right.
I'm very glad you brought it up. I think the Democrats are in a very good position if they don't blow it. She's a very good horse trader and coalition builder. The Democratic Party today has an extremely powerful left wing that doesn't help them in terms of national elections. And I think her major challenge and she's in a good position as a woman and a San Francisco liberal in terms of her heritage. She's in a good position to rein in the left, but how she operates will have a lot of influence on how the Democrats do in 2020.
Right. And of course, what you're saying is what matters a lot more than how somebody comes across on TV is what are they like in the room when they are sitting across the table from fellow Democrats and sitting across the table from their opponents as well.
We started out talking about the first Bush. We had a reception for CEOs who, like the Hebrews after Moses, were literally wandering around without John Connolly. It was amazing to watch. The Reagan people turned down a meeting with CEOs in 1980. And in consequence, John Riley, the president of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations and my boss, and I had an opportunity to sit around, literally, with former Governor Reagan and Nancy Reagan for a small lunch before he made his foreign policy speech, and I asked him about this decision, and much to my surprise, it was not a staff decision. And the future president proceeded to tell me, no, no, Mr. Sear, if you want to become president of the United States, you have to convince the average worker, the woman and man struggling to make a living and help their family, that you understand their problems, especially if you're a Republican, because we're seen as the party of the rich.